The Battle of Lewes was only the most obvious manifestation of the Barons' Wars in Sussex. The impact of the wars on the county lasted well beyond the cataclysmic day of the 14th of May 1264, and the events in and people of Sussex profoundly affected the ebb and flow of national politics and the outcome of the war. In many ways, Sussex represents a microcosm of England during the 1250s and 1260s, as many of the themes discussed today were present in the county. There was resentment amongst the gentry at the oppressions of royal and magnate officials. The county was affected by the factionalism at Henry's court between the Savoyards and the Lusignans. Foreigners became victims of the general xenophobic atmosphere. The county was fertile ground for the overweening ambitions of the de Montfort clan, while, above all, it was disturbed both before, during and after the wars by Henry III's irredeemable favouritism and poor judgment. Whenever medieval or early modern historians embark on studies of individual counties, they give a myriad of reasons why their chosen area is unique and anomalous. I am no different. Medieval Sussex had more than its fair share of quirks in landholding and administration. Like many counties, Sussex was twinned administratively with another, in this case, the much smaller Surrey. The sheriff operated from the royal castle of Guildford, and Sussex was one of the few counties with no castle of the royal domain. The lack of a royal castle reflected an administrative situation unique to Sussex. Like every county, Sussex was subdivided into governmental units known as hundreds. You can see them all there. Each hundred was administered in the king's name by the hundred bailiff. Everywhere else, counties consisted of a mixture of royal hundreds, where the hundred bailiff was appointed by the sheriff, and private hundreds, where the bailiff was appointed by the lord who owned the franchise, who also kept the profits of the hundred court. In Sussex, however, all 56 hundreds were held privately by the lords of the rapes, another feature unique to the shire. By the mid-13th century, Sussex had six rapes, which, as you can see on the map, from west to east, were Chichester, Arundel, Bramber, Lewes, Pevensey, and Hastings. The lord of the rape was the only non-clerical tenant-in-chief of the king. The number of manors retained in hand, or domain, by the lord varied between the rapes, so that while the resident Warren lords of Lewes had still had 15 manors in domain in the mid-13th century, the absentee Norman counts of that's EU, who held Hastings rape until the early 13th century, had just five. Beneath the lord of the rape, there were usually three or four major knightly families who held several manors from the lord. Such families included the Etchinghams and St. Ledgers in Hastings rape, the St. John's and Sansevers in Chichester, and the Poynings and Plays families in Lewes. The rapes made Sussex a very vertical county. Everything ran north-south rather than east-west, a lasting legacy, as anyone who's driven across Sussex will know. It was much more common for Sussex knightly families to have lands outside the county than for them to have manors in more than one rape within the shire. William Bardolph, for instance, held three manors in Lewes rape, but was also an extensive landholder in Norfolk, Leicestershire, Nottinghamshire, and Lincolnshire. The St. John's of Holnacre in Chichester rape were major landholders elsewhere in southern England, and many families of eastern Sussex, like the Hastings of Netherfield, held manors in Kent. Eastern Sussex and Kent were also the home of the Cinque Ports, which were major players in Sussex politics and the local economy. The three Sussex ports were Hastings, Rye, and Winchelsea. The Cinque Ports were unique to Kent and Sussex and played a major role in the Barons' Wars on the Montfortian side. Like all counties, large swathes of Sussex were held by various ecclesiastical lords. As today, the county was coterminous with the Diocese of Chichester, and the bishops of Chichester were major landlords, especially in the west near their cathedral. The bishops in the mid-13th century were devout reformers, the most notable of whom was Richard Wych, who died in 1253 and was quickly canonized as St. Richard of Chichester. Wych was followed by two local bishops, John of Climping and then Stephen Burstead, Wych's former chaplain and a prominent supporter of Simon de Montfort. Sussex's largest, richest and most prominent houses, including the cathedral church itself, moved from Selsey in 1075, were Norman Conquest foundations, established in the generation after 1066. Most notable were the Benedictine Battle Abbey, founded by the Conqueror himself, and the Cistercian Priory of St. Pancras here in Lewes, established in 1076 by William and Gundrada de Warenne. The late 12th and early 13th centuries saw a second wave of religious foundation in Sussex, including the Cistercian Abbey of Robertsbridge, the Augustinian canons at Mitcham, and the Benedictine nunnery of Rusper, founded by the Breos Lords of Bramber. The second quarter of the 13th century saw the arrival of the friars in Sussex. And by the 1250s, there were two friaries at Chichester and one at Arundel, Lewes and Winchelsea. There were a number of ecclesiastical estates in Sussex held by prelates from outside the county. Most significantly, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had manors all over Sussex, but particularly in the Hundred of Aldwick in Arundel Rape, and the huge manor of Morling in Lewes Rape, with his hunting lodge nearby at Mayfield. The Archbishop was, of course, one of the great magnates of England, and he was representative of a number of prominent men who held outlying estates in Sussex, but whose main holdings lay elsewhere in England. Richard of Cornwall, the king's brother, held the city of Chichester, though he leased control to the local citizens. Simon de Montfort himself had the manor of Fletching. Hugh Bigod held the wealthy manor of Bosham. Henry III's chief counsellor, John Mansell, began his ecclesiastical career in Sussex, and the manor of Sedgwick near Horsham was one of his principal possessions. The famous northern family of Percy held the manor of Petworth. There was also John de Burgh, son of the famous regent and justiciar Hubert de Burgh, who held the manors of East Chiltington and Portslade here in Lewes Rape. Finally, it is important to acknowledge the influence in Sussex of the de Clare Earls of Gloucester. Their castle of Tunbridge lies just a few miles from the Sussex border, and the surrounding Lowy stretched across it. Their proximity to Sussex made them a dynamic influence on Sussex politics. This overview of Sussex and its patterns of landholding provides the foundation onto which it is possible to build a picture of what happened in the county and why before, during, and after the period of reform and rebellion. The story of Sussex in the Barons' Wars starts in the early 1240s, with significant changes at the very top of Sussex society, with two deaths, a well-connected immigrant, and two disappointed exiles. The death in 1243 of the last d'Aubigny Earl of Arundel saw the arrival in Sussex of the FitzAlan family. Until now, the FitzAlans had been minor barons on the Welsh March, but after the division of the d'Aubigny lands, the young John FitzAlan received the Rape and Castle of Arundel. Of more immediate significance, however, was the arrival in Sussex in 1241 of the well-connected immigrant, Peter of Savoy. Peter was what might today be termed a non-dom, splitting his time between England and Savoy. A younger son of the Count of Savoy, Peter was the most prominent of the foreigners who came to England in the train of Henry's young queen, Eleanor of Provence, whose maternal uncle he was. Henry treated Peter with lavish generosity. In May 1241, he was granted the honour of Richmond in Yorkshire. And in September 1241, he was granted custody of the rapes of both Pevensey and Lewes. In November 1241, he was also given Rochester Castle, Dover Castle, and the Cinque Ports, an unprecedented consolidation of power in the southeast in the hands of one man, and a foreigner to boot, who had only been in the country 11 months. Such was the resentment that this caused that Henry soon backtracked, and in March 1242, the Kentish castles were taken back. But Peter was still left in control of his new Sussex estates. The previous Lord of Pevensey Rape had died in 1231, and his English lands were taken into the king's hands. effectively disinheriting his Norman nephew and heir, the first of our disappointed exiles. The rape was alternatively in the hands of the king, administered by local knights or royal favourites, until it came into Peter of Savoy's possession in 1241. While Peter's hold on Pevensey became permanent, his possession of Lewes was not. It was occasioned by the death of William Earl Warrenne in 1240. Earl William had dominated Sussex politics for nearly 40 years, and his young son, John, came into royal wardship. Initially, Lewes was placed in the hands of William de Monceau, Lord of Hurstmonceux and executor of Earl William. The king's decision to replace a trusted local executor with a foreign interloper was both controversial and foolhardy. The proper maintenance of estates in wardship had been addressed by Magna Carta, thanks to the notorious plundering of such lands under King John. Any fears the young John de Warrenne might have had were amply justified. In June 1243, while Henry was abroad, the Archbishop of York, as regent, ordered an inquisition into alleged waste committed by Peter of Savoy in the Warrenne lands. The Sussex and Surrey juries reported widespread wasting of Warrenne's lands, especially in his woods. Over 200 oaks and more than 500 beech trees had been cut down and sold, burnt or taken into Pevensey rape, damage worth hundreds of pounds. Peter's men had been selling off all kinds of wood, and the Sussex jury stated boldly that if such sales were to continue until the heir were of age, the whole forest, woods and park would be almost devastated. It is significant that it was not until Henry was abroad that such an investigation could be launched against one of his foreign favourites, and there is no evidence that Peter was punished for this blatant infringement of Magna Carta. Insult was added to injury when, in May 1243, Peter was granted rights over the marriage of Isabel, widow of the Earl of Arundel, and John de Warrenne's sister. Other Savoyards were also being given lands in Sussex by King Henry. And, given the presence of Peter's younger brother, Boniface, as Archbishop of Canterbury, it must have felt to the young John de Warrenne as if there was a Savoyard takeover of a county where the Lords of Lewes had been the dominant power for generations. Henry's cavalier attitude to Warrenne's inheritance created a bitter enmity between the future Earl and the Savoyards. His marriage to the king's Lusignan half-sister, Alice, in 1247, would certainly have mollified Warrenne's pride, but it only served to deepen the divide between him and the Queen's party. It is not surprising, therefore, to find that one of his first public acts upon regaining Reigate and Lewes was to join the infamous Lusignan raid on Lambeth Palace in 1252. Warrenne's grievances against the Savoyards only grew deeper when, in 1254, the Lincolnshire towns of Stamford and Grantham, given to his father in compensation for the family's lost lands in Normandy, were now given to Lord Edward, still at this time firmly under the control and influence of the Queen and her relatives. The recovery of these towns became the overriding aim of Warrenne's ambitions. Warrenne remained firmly in the Lusignan camp even after the death of his wife in 1256, and was part of their effort to win control over Lord Edward. Warrenne was knighted with Edward in Spain in 1254, at the time of the latter's marriage to Eleanor of Castile. By 1257, he was part of the group of young knights whom Lord Edward was gathering around him, several of whom had links with the Lusignans. Warrenne's attitude during the period of reform and rebellion has often been seen as wayward, as he switched sides on several occasions. But his attitude is actually remarkably consistent. Whichever position the Queen and the Savoyards took, Warrenne invariably took the opposite. Peter and Warrenne were both close allies of the king, but, thanks to Henry's bungling, were bitter enemies of each other. This situation was easily avoidable had Henry III shown more skill and tact in the 1240s. That Henry was oblivious to the problem he was creating in Sussex is evident from his grant of Hastings' rape to Peter in October 1249. The rape had been in royal hands since 1225, when the Regency government confiscated it from its rightful owner, Alice, Countess of Eu, the second of our disappointed exiles. Alice repeatedly petitioned to have the rape restored, but as a Norman under the allegiance of the King of France, this was refused. Peter held the rape until 1254, when it formed part of the appanage of Lord Edward. Sussex was thus a key battleground in the growing conflict in the 1250s between the Lusignans and the Savoyards. But the county was also affected by several other of the key themes of this period, one of which was growing resentment at the excesses of royal government. The Sussex shrievalty was only joined to that of Surrey in 1242. Prior to that, the Sussex sheriffs had mostly been precisely the kind of substantial local figures of whom the reformers of 1258-9 would have approved. The first holder of the joint shrievalty, Sir Ralph Camoys, was another local knight of substance. But by the 1250s, the situation had changed. Henry was no longer willing or able to find significant local men to serve as sheriff, and those who did fill the office were either minor local landholders like Geoffrey de Cruche of Surrey, or outsiders like William Mitchell Deaver from Hampshire or Gerard de Evington of Middlesex. Many Sussex knights, keen to avoid the hassle and expense of royal service, obtained exemptions from local office during the 1250s. Evidence of how the demands Henry was placing on his local officials to obtain money was causing what John Maddicott has called a retreat from office holding by the county elites. It is easy to see why such men wanted no part of the king's government when one looks at the exactions the sheriffs were expected to obtain from Sussex. In April 1254, for example, the sheriff was ordered to purvey at short notice an assortment of different goods for the Queen's voyage to Gascony, including, but not restricted to, 720 poultry, 30,000 eggs, 40,000 plates, 100 gallons of vinegar, and 100 cakes. The sheriff was also expected regularly to provide large amounts of meat for various feasts the king held at Westminster. In July 1257, the sheriff was ordered to provide 100 good archers from Sussex for service in faraway Wales, and was expected to have them at Chester within 2 weeks under threat of severe penalties if he failed to comply. The most grievous burden placed on the men of Surrey and Sussex, however, was for the building works at Guildford Castle. Between 1252 and 1257, the king ordered the sheriff to levy locally and spend more than £300 on the castle. The fire there in 1254 only served to increase the burden on those expected to pay for the improvements. One of the adornments Henry ordered was a painting of the biblical story of Dives and Lazarus to remind him to be charitable. The irony that others had paid for this seems to have been lost on him, although perhaps somebody pointed it out because a few months later it was whitewashed. Despite all this, Henry was not friendless in Sussex. There were several knights in royal service in the 1250s, including William St. Leger of Hastings Rape, William de Hastencott of Bramber Rape, and Robert Aguillon, Lord of Perching in Lewis Rape, and a figure of growing importance in Sussex. For all the exactions of royal government, there is no evidence to suggest that magnate rule was any less oppressive, another theme of the revolution of 1258-9. Great lords were keen to extend and exercise their rights, often at the expense of their knightly tenants. Both Warenne and Peter of Savoy were accused of appropriating the hunting right of Free Warren within their lordship to the great damage of the locality. Both men were also vigorous in pressing for their feudal rights of suit of court and castle guard, both of which were highly unpopular. Those close to the king felt that they had almost a free hand to behave however they wished, without fear of reprisal. In October 1257, for instance, Warenne's steward at Lewes impounded 200 sheep belonging to Robert of Cliff, obviously nearby Lewes. The case roll records that, on account of the might and power of the Earl, the sheriff found it exceedingly difficult to restore Cliff's animals. Warenne swiftly exacted revenge at Cliff's presumption in seeking to do so by seizing Cliff's groom in Lewes and detaining him in the castle. When Cliff came to set him free, Warenne's steward beat him monstrously and put him in the stocks for 5 days before bearing him away in a blanket, having first relieved him of his horse and 40 shillings. It was not until the heir of Hugh Bigod, the justiciar, that Cliff was able to obtain justice. A similar story can be said against the royal household knight, Robert Aguillon. Ralph of Imworth had to wait 10 years until Bigod's heir gave him justice for Aguillon's violence against him and seizure of his property. Aguillon was eventually imprisoned for a short time, but it is no surprise to find that Imworth was to fight and die at Lewes on the baronial side.